Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Happy to have you with us. But first, I want to tell you about one of the sponsors we have here on the show. The NFL draft is one of the most anticipated days of any football fan's calendar, and that also means fantasy football season is not too far behind. DynastySportsEmpire.com is going to change the way you play fantasy football. DSE offers fantasy football gamers of all skill levels an opportunity to draft and retain your well-maintained rosters and players for their entire NFL career. Highlighted with large rosters, high-scoring games, easy payouts, and an amazing online community, DSE has everything you would want in a challenging online experience. Please visit them online today at DynastySportsEmpire.com. That's DynastySportsEmpire.com. And check out all the amazing upcoming formats for this upcoming fantasy football season. Go check them out. We got a great episode for you today, so let's get to it.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Hello, fans. Hello, listeners. Hello, Mike. Mike, I would have been down here 3 minutes earlier, but I took out a cheese stick, and I misplaced the cheese stick for about 3 minutes, and it was driving me a little crazy on where I placed my cheese stick before we recorded.
You generally walk around the entire household when you obtain cheese sticks from the refrigerator, so it's like...
I'm getting.
Have I checked the canoe? It could be there.
That's how I know I'm getting older and stupider, because I can't find anything anymore. Like I put it somewhere and it just is gone. And I look forever, and then my wife will be like, "Oh, it's right here." I'm like, "Oh my God!" Like for instance, I'm really upset. I had this awesome shark bathing suit a couple years ago, and it was my party bathing suit. And my shark bathing suit has just disappeared off the earth. I find shirts and things that I'll wear a couple times. I'll be like, whatever happened to that shirt? And it's just gone into the ethos somewhere. I don't do much either where I'm like taking my shirt off and leaving it places. So I don't understand where these things go.
Come on, Scott. I know, you know, the Verbal Shenanigans comedy show is coming up. I know you just go up there and you go Hulk Hogan up there. That's like your opening thing. You just, what's up, ladies?
I just Bert Kreischer it. I just shirt off right away.
Right away. Like, Real American is blasting through your sound system as you're just tearing into it, and, like, the place is going nuts. And then you're like, oh, crap, I'm a comedian. I'm supposed to say something now.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's might be how it goes, considering it's going to be basically over a year since the last time I did live performance. So it could end up me doing that in the end anyway.
Well, I mean... In the grand scheme of awkward performances, I can't fathom this upcoming one being the most awkward. So yeah. I think you should be fine.
Yeah. So in 1 week, I have the. So when this comes out, this already had happened. But I have our show back at Tap House 15. I have an outdoor show at the lake, and then the weekend after that, I'm officiating my friend's wedding. That was supposed to be, if you remember, we talked about that last year. So there's a lot of different public speaking events coming up for me.
Is there any chance you'll get them mixed up and then, like, you're saying vows during the Verbal Shenanigans comedy show, and then you're just doing, like, 15 minutes of crowd work during the wedding?
I will say that I've been writing the ceremony, and I when I'm actually able to sit down and write something that I'm not, like, used to, like, whether it's a bit for this show or a new joke, I really enjoy writing, but, like, it's like... It's one of those things, like, I'm like, man, when I'm doing it, I'm like, why don't I do this all the time? Take 30 minutes a night and write. And then before you know it, months go by, and I'm like, man, I just look at my phone and I save things under notes, and I have no idea what half of them mean. Like, I totally forget them because I forget to flush them out and, you know, try to write them. But I will say for this wedding, it is a difficult task because – I know they're hiring me because I'm their friend and I'm I don't know if you call, not certified, ordained, I guess you could say, as a minister from this show, actually.
You're welcome, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
Would you have done it if I did not challenge you? Yes or no?
If somebody had asked me, I would have gotten done it.
Just common conversation. You're at the bar and all, yeah, I'm getting married in a few months. Hey, would you get ordained for me?
It's happened. But my cousin asked my other cousin if they would marry him. So, I would do it. And the thought had crossed my mind before. Like, it'd be kind of neat to marry like a friend or something like that. But anyway, I will say the challenge is definitely like, okay, they're hiring me because I'm their friend, and they don't want a priest, right? They don't want any. So, and maybe at times I am funny. So I expect them to be like, okay, well, you're gonna make the ceremony a little bit funny, but you got to make it serious at the same time. And then I'm worried about length.
Like, got to balance it. Yeah. Got to balance it.
I don't want to be speaking for 5 hours, but they told me that they don't want it too short because they've been to weddings where the ceremony is like 5 seconds long and it's kind of awkward almost. It's so short. But then I've been to ceremonies where like, oh my God, I just want cocktail hour. Like, I don't want to be that guy for the audience. So this is like approaching, like, I'm like nervous to bomb as the officiant. It's a different kind of bomb.
Like, what is the average? Is there a number out there?
I don't know. In my head, I think the sweet spot, personally, would be about 20 minutes. I think that's perfect.
Average length.
Because, let's face it, ceremony. Everybody at a ceremony, the thing they're thinking about is, I can't wait to get to cocktail hour. Because as soon as this ceremony is over, I could have a drink and eat mini hot dogs. That is what everybody's thinking about. So I have to pepper it with a good amount of jokes, but I don't want it to make it a routine. So it's becoming a little bit of something that I know. So the wedding from where we're recording now is it's Tuesday night. So the wedding's in a week and a half on Saturday. So I know like that Thursday, Friday night, I will be like sitting up after the baby go and the wife go to bed, kind of like really fine tuning in, maybe even reading it out loud, which I don't read my jokes out loud anymore or anything I do out loud anymore until there's an audience.
So Google is telling me about 20 to 30 minutes is the appropriate time right there. So here's what I'm thinking. Fly out to Vegas, go to those drive-through wedding chapels, and that will be your open mic. Just marry people. You just shove them on through. And all it's, you know, if you screw up, you're like, ah, God damn it. I'll wait for this Jamaican couple to come up, I'll really kill it on that one.
Work the efficient material for like a night or two out there.
Yeah, you know, like really feel it out. Like, granted, you'll have to tell your wife you're working late. And she's like, you work at a school. And it's like, yeah, night school.
Yeah, right.
That's the overtime.
So I'm a little nervous. Not nervous. I can't say that I get nervous anymore. Like comedy-wise, I found maybe over the last – the most nervous I was doing that first Zoom comedy show. That I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a disaster. But I did know that if I bombed, that I would just turn the computer off and go back to like watching Netflix. So it wasn't the worst like fear. I've been more nervous back in the day for comedy sets where you drive like an hour and a half and you're getting paid nothing and you're kind of doing like an audition. But I will say over the years, I've found ways to kind of almost like use nervous energy to my advantage. Like,
okay.
Like, I feel like if I'm not feeling something before a set, I'm not in it, like, completely. My heart's not in it. Like, I got to feel a little bit of, like, nerves to jump on the stage. And I guess there's a difference in my head. It's hard to explain between, like, good nerves and bad nerves. But I've definitely at least crossed that plateau in comedy. Jokes, I have no idea. you know, talent, I have no idea. But I definitely have figured out how to not go into panic mode from the beginning, how to just kind of use the energy and kind of ease into my set rather than being like, hey guys, and then boom, right, joke number one. Like, it's kind of like, ah, I'm going to dress the room for a while. I'm going to kind of, you know, take it in and then kind of slowly get into it. And I know how to, if a joke bombs, it's not like it used to be where like, oh my God, I'm derailed. We can't land this plane. Like, all right, it bombs. I can laugh at myself, you know?
So you're kind of like that coach on the NFL team that's like very weirdly specific. Like, you're the quarterback's coach. Mm-hmm. It just It just, it's like, ah, I just know how to take care of this. You come to me, I'm going to make you the greatest and feeling your nerves. You're like, oh, you want to be head coach? Absolutely not. I will be terrible. I will destroy your franchise. We will be done for many years to come. But if you need somebody who need, if you want to have the best third string quarterback in the league, you come to Scotty Brennan.
I sometimes do think about that, like the assistant coach role. Like I've done assistant coach for different things with soccer teams and whatnot. It's by far the best role. By far. The pressure is off you a little bit. You can kind of fine-tune certain things and be assistant, and not all the pressure's on you. Like, I think if you're, like you just brought up, like a quarterback's coach, if you're a really good quarterback's coach and you're not, like, always striving to become a head coach, and if you just settled into that spot, you could be a quarterback's coach forever. Like, forever.
Who was that? Who was the one that won the Super Bowl with Peyton with the Broncos, and then he became a head coach, and he was like
Gase.
The most legend. Yeah,
yeah, Adam
the
Gase.
Most legendary, horrible,
it's horrific.
Head coach in the history of coaches. Yeah, he could have just sat back and like his job was 10 times easier because it's Peyton Manning.
Right.
Like, what has Peyton Manning not done as a quarterback where he's like, I need some advice?
Yeah. And, like, if you stay in that lane and you're just happy with that, I feel like you could have a really long NFL career because you need you got to remember, the NFL, if you have one good season as a backup, you can be hired, like, 4 more times on little contracts here and there. You know, we're talking about the Matt Flynn's of the world and the Matt Castle's of the world. Like, they made a career out of having one good year, basically, essentially. Yeah. Even a couple games, you could say. Flynn had, like, 3 good games. So if you stay in your lane and, like, let's say you took a team to the playoffs or even the Super Bowl as the quarterback coach and you just stay there, I bet you can continuously get hired in that role because they're not going to be like, oh, you're not a head coach. I just want to be the quarterback's coach, man. That's it.
Yeah. I feel I would be a good holder coach. Like, my whole job would just be like, listen, when that ball hits your hand, I want you to put it down and put your finger on the top of it. I don't want to be playing around. We're not going to do any trick plays. That's for the special teams coach to coach you at.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you, no, you see that ball coming at you? Catch it.
I would not be surprised if things are that specialized these days. There's so many coaches for everything. I would not be surprised if they have a holder coach come in every once in a while.
That's very interesting. You use your index finger instead of your pinky finger to hold it. Intriguing. You might be going to the Hall of Fame one day, my friend. You're changing the holding world as we know it.
Yeah. So I got those things coming up. I don't know how that all sprung out of a cheese stick. But you ever have snacks that you've been eating since you were a kid that still bring you joy? Because a cheese stick is something I definitely had when I was like 8 years old.
Cheese sticks are good. I guess pudding cups.
Ooh.
That still puts me in a good spot. Like, somebody offers you a pudding cup, it's never no. You could have just ate like an ox, and somebody offers you a pudding cup, you're like, I'll find room.
See, I'm not a big pudding. I mean, I would try a pudding cup now, but I'm not a big pudding guy. I could picture you definitely tongue the container, don't you, when you're done?
Oh, easily.
I can see it. Just getting in there.
It's like handing it off to the dog, and you get it back, and it's like, well, this is a brand new container. Right. I don't know. I never thought pudding was in there at some point.
Yeah. Do you even use – be honest with me. Have you ever eaten a pudding cup with no spoon, just went straight for the tongue and guzzling method?
I don't think so. If I did, I'd be honest and spew it out. No, I don't think so, because I've known there have been times where pudding cup, and then there's no spoon, and there's like this panic.
Yeah.
But like, I did panic where I'm just like, all right, I'm just going to shot this thing. I'm just going to put it right down. It was just like nervous energy of, what the heck's the spoon? What the heck's the spoon? Just like not calming down until I can get one.
Was there anything more devastating when you were young than getting a Capri Sun for lunch and that straw wasn't attached to it?
Oh, yeah.
The straw disappeared somewhere. First off, The challenge, do you know how many times I would blast a straw through the back of the Capri Sun and then I have a back hole and then I'm trying to suck it, like the juice out and it's coming out the back because I couldn't land the straw correctly?
Like, there's, I don't know how when they were building this product, like they had any quality assurance whatsoever. There is no way somebody saw that bag of juice and said, yes, this is perfect. This is how we want to give refreshment to young children.
And it was always like it was always very disappointing to like have to ask like the lunch aide or like your teacher to help you poke a hole in your Capri Sun. It was very demeaning, you know. They're like, oh man, like I can't do it on my own. And they gotta like poke it with a scissor because you bent the straw.
Yeah, like if the straw is broken, the only thing you can do is cut off the top and just chug it open.
Chug your bag of juice.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm old school enough to know when there was metal pudding cans and that freaking key came off and you're like, no!
Yeah.
No dessert! No, there's no physical way to get in this container.
Oh, man. I haven't thought about a metal pudding can in 20 years.
Oh, easily. Yeah, I bring the old school stories here to Verbal Shenanigans.
Burlew's metal pudding can. Throw
back. No, I would not sell that. I will sell dehumidifier water. I will not sell metal pudding cup. There is too much trauma when that key comes off and that lid ain't open.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And then, like, you would get, sometimes I would go into my, like, lunch bag and there'd be no straw for the stupid Capri Sun, and then it's just like instant panic. Like you're like, I remember sometimes not even drinking it, just throwing it back in my backpack. Be like, well, no, I guess it's water fountain for me today.
Yeah, it lost all purpose. I mean, it's terrible. Even if you got a can of soda and the top cracks up, you can still get like some kind of blunt object and push it down and get into your thing. There's nothing you can do with a Capri Sun. I wanted to interview the guy who invented it just to yell at that person. I'm assuming a guy. It could have been a woman. I don't know. I'm not sexist. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, man. I think when we went to like grade school, you're a tiny bit older than me, but not by much. We definitely like, I think in like the 60s, 70s, people were eating pretty good food. Like people were still growing food. Then like the 80s, 90s came around and kids' lunches were a disaster. Like,
oh, easily.
I would have a Snapple every single day, a Little Debbie's cake, and like a ham sandwich every single day, like the same thing. And I remember just having those for whatever reason. I think I've even talked about this here, but the zebra cakes. They were the little white ones with the chocolate on top. Then they were vanilla cake in the middle.
Yeah.
I just remember always reaching into my lunch bag and they would just be demolished. Like they would just be the remnants of cake, like cake dust. And yet when you were hungry, you still open the thing up and you're like pouring little cake dust in your hand, just making a mess all over the lunch table. Like I can't even think of eating those things anymore because like the thought of them grosses me out.
Well, zebra cakes weren't my go-to for Little Debbie's. I was probably, where's those ones called? The chocolate cakes. They're like, they look like candy bars. They're thick, and it's kind of got the vanilla swirl in there.
Like a Yodel?
It's like a Yodel, but that's not its name.
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, that was usually my go-to there.
Ecto Cooler was I used to have that a lot.
I remember that. Yeah, that's old school with Slimer in the front.
Yep,
that was good stuff.
Yeah, and then like even after us, like kind of as we phased out of like school age, then they came out with like Lunchables, like the kids.
Oh yeah,
just terrible like the most processed foods possible. Like just made in a factory and sorted into boxes.
It's like if they taught a computer what food was, and then you just built a program, and it's like, all right, make food, and that's what the program spits out.
Yes.
It's like technical, but you want to say, okay, there's a few issues with your design right here.
Yeah, and I feel like it only took until, like, maybe 10 years ago for people to, like, remember, like, oh, yeah, fruits. Oh, yeah, you know, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. vegetable. Like, Like, I see my friends with their kids. They don't feed them any of that crap. Like, they actually give them, like, fruits, and they cut up vegetables, and maybe they have, like, veggie straws. Like, I think we just got the 20 years of history where they were just like, eh. You know, like, it's easy, it's quick, it's microwavable, whatever it is, they can have it.
My fruit was basically a flat line that was stuck to a piece of plastic. It's a fruit roll-up.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was my fruit for my lunch.
How great was getting a fruit by the foot? Oh, my God, I used to crush this thing. But taking the end and just whipping them down so they extend all the way. just so cathartic. Like, you just whip it and then whip the paper off. Or, like, were you – now, your fruit by the foot strategy – were you able to actually, like, were you a guy who actually, like, poked out the shapes and stuff that were in it? Or did you just, say screw that and just go, just eat the whole thing?
I don't think when my roll-up days were over in my lunches, I don't think I was around when the footlongs came out. Like, it was just a regular, okay, we have a normal size of smush fruit. Then we got to your generation and we're like, listen,
we need 3 feet.
They're measuring it. Can we give them like 6x6? No, man, you gotta give them the full foot. They ain't gonna take this.
Yeah, well, the fruit roll up though, also, like, they had the little shapes, like star, like there was different themes you can get. And mm-hmm. I didn't mess with that. I would just eat the whole thing, sometimes shrub the whole thing in my mouth at once, like, just savage
animal.
Gushers came out. I remember my mom would get, like, a pack of Gushers randomly because they were kind of expensive. And pick, oh, my God, Gushers. And you try to, like, you try not to eat the whole box in, like, a day, but, like, Gushers, there'd be, like, 8 of them in a pack. And you're like, really? Really? You're going to give me this delicious, squishy fruit bomb, and then I'm going to get 8 of these? You plow that box in a sitting.
Yeah, that's when we go Halloween, that's a fun size. Right. That's not a normal size. And we're growing boys. We need at least 20 Gushers in a bag.
I agree.
Minimum.
You should find out who made. You should get the Capri Sun guy on a cast along with the Gushers manufacturer.
Gotcha.
And we should just really take them to task, like, 30 years later for what they did. Now, I remember fruit snacks. I remember the best ones were like the ShopRite brand one or the food. They were just the dots, but you would get like a million of them in a pack as opposed to like the ones that had like a theme or something to them. You get like 20 and you're like, come on, 20 like little dots. Get out of here.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a generic brand for you. And all you know, nobody brags about the generic brand. Nobody's like, listen, I know you love your Kicks, but you got to try Kroger's corn circles. It's amazing.
That just sounds terrible. Kroger's corn circles. Oh, God.
I just see like a farmer like dancing in a TV commercial to Kroger's corn circles.
It's Kroger's corn circles. Healthy for your kid. Oh, God. Well, we're going to bring on a guy who could actually talk with some intelligence. Unlike we're talking about food that we ate. This guy is a man who can grow his own food and has lived off his own food. I think it's time to segue to our guest here. Mike, who do we got?
Tonight we are speaking with Dr. Mark Nelson. Now, Dr. Nelson was a member of the 8-person Biospherian crew for the first 2-year Biosphere 2 closure experiment. That happened back in 1991 through 93. Right now, he is the chairman of the Institute of Ecotechnics and head of the Wastewater Garden International and has worked for several decades in closed ecological systems research, restoration of damaged ecosystems, and desert agriculture and wastewater recycling. So we're going to find out how much life is left on this earth tonight, I guess, Scott.
And what it was like to work side by side with Pauly Shore.
Absolutely.
yeah, we're really we're rocking out the science guests. Two big science guests in a row here. We got to go from wildfires.
And like, maybe we'll get smart one of these days. I don't know.
Let's not get crazy. But let's get Dr. Mark Nelson on the line.
So, Mark, I guess right off the bat, I mean, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of you going into the biosphere. I guess my first question is it kind of like jail where it just gets back in your brain, you start thinking about it over and over again?
It wasn't anything like jail, but I do go back to it because it was a really wild and very rich time for me. 2 years of my life wasn't just 2 years of my life inside Biosphere 2. I was part of the Institute of Ecotechnics, which came up with the idea. We started, formulating and gathering the amazing crew of ecologists, engineers, and assorted whatever we needed for the project in 1984. So the project was really 7 years in the making.
I mean, I guess if you're going to get trapped in a room for 2 years, I guess you got to have a little planning to it. But I mean, you being a New Yorker and all, what caught you kind of in like the ecology kind of thing? Brooklyn's not mostly known for its wildlife, but.
Have you spent time in Prospect Park in Brooklyn?
Probably not.
I think when I was growing up, there was actually a famous book, which I'm not sure I read, called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. No, but I take your point. Here I was, a Jewish immigrant kid, first generation born in the U.S. of Polish and Russian Jewish immigrants, growing up in New York City, Brooklyn, then Flushing, Queens, and going to, with a full scholarship, I will add, a Ivy League college. And at the age of about 21 or 22, I had credentials and a deep understanding that I knew how to do nothing. And all of the career prospects in front of me looked really, really boring, like become a medical doctor, a lawyer, a professor, oh, God forbid. So I set out to, what was inconceivable to me, New Mexico. New Yorkers are famous for their lack of geography. And
yeah.
So at the age of 22, when I arrived at Sinergia Ranch, from which I am speaking to you now, I think my ecological life began or began to become quite serious. And, we had a very can-do attitude. You learn by doing. So our first project was this ranch, completely desolated, absolutely ecologically destroyed in a surprising short period of time. And we said, well, let's see if we can make an oasis in the desert. And John Allen, the visionary of Ecotechnics and Biosphere 2, maybe as an Oklahoma joke, put me in charge of gardens and trees. And at that point, I had planted neither a seed nor a tree and knew very damn little about either. So you start from where you're at. And we always used to joke at our ecotechnic projects, and this sort of grew to different projects around the world and eventually Biosphere 2, our most high profile, but not necessarily, the singular event of our lives. We said, we'll work with willing and competence. If you're willing and incompetent, then you haven't been brainwashed and you may actually come up with really creative ideas that the people with credentials and, in the experience of doing such and such may not come up with.
So what were you like as a kid? Were you just drawn to science? Were you like an excellent student growing up, or did you start? I guess that's a no.
I guess that answers that.
But
I was an excellent student. The immigrant story.
Right.
For my parents, and they were pretty old when they had me, so they actually came to the U.S. in the 1920s. you know, they understood, they had a great regard for culture and education. They had no money, basically. They were pretty blue-collar Jews without money kind of people. But, you know, they impressed on me and my brother, you know, the path to success in the U.S. of A. is getting education. So, you know how it is when you look back on your life and it's like, was I actually making these decisions or was I carrying out the cultural program? So, yeah, you know, I did really well in high school. Dartmouth College gave me a full scholarship to go up to New Hampshire, another unimaginable place, and, you know, do 4 years of Ivy League education. And during that time, of course, was the birth of the environmental movement. And there was a sense in the 1960s among a great deal of that generation that even if you had material success, how hollow is that? You know, how do we make a meaningful life? So very symbolically, when I got my summa cum laude, you know, diploma from Dartmouth, I remember handing it to my, you know, my Polish-born mother, Minnie, and kind of saying, well, maybe I'll go off script at this point, because I was really desperate to, like, find something new. And really good luck brought me to this, you know, gang of intrepid souls who had started a theater, the Theater of All Possibilities. A few years after I arrived, we decided to make a little research institute, the Institute of Ecotechnics. And I hope we have time to talk about that, because even back then, it's before global climate change and, you know, whatever is now dominating young minds, it was really clear that humans were absolutely abusing the biosphere. And so our ecotechnics was designed to, you know, see, can we put into practice projects in challenging environments where we actually improve the harmony between human needs and desires and ecological happiness and upgrade.
What's kind of like the big striving thing with the ecotechnics? Is it more recycling, reusable, coming up with new materials? Like, kind of give us a broad idea. Is it literally just trying to figure out what is the best answer?
Well, you know, as I said before, you know, we only took projects, you know, that seemed to us required a solution and conventional solutions didn't work. So, New Mexico, you know, why not do adobe buildings, organic agriculture? I planted, you know, after I learned what a tree was about and, you know, how it might prosper. You know, we did projects like that, or a Puerto Rican project. Okay, we're going to go into the rainforest, the tropical rainforest of Puerto Rico, and we're going to work on sustainable forestry, not just, you know, drawing a boundary around a primary forest and saying, keep out. And I'm all for that. I think we should protect more of the earth. No, we were drawn to challenges that conventional approaches just absolutely didn't work. And if you forget about profit maximization and you have a group of people who are willing to make an enterprise, make an endeavor of these projects, you know, sweat equity, you know, does a lot when you have a group of people who can live, and because you're living in a community, you bring the economics down. So that was kind of the driving force. We didn't want to just pick haphazard projects. And if it was too easy, it's not worth our, you know, trying to be inventive and creative and figuring out a new solution to. So now, Biosphere 2, of course, is a great example of that.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. For people who are listening and they may have only heard of the biosphere, or, you know, they or they might have no idea exactly what we're talking about. Can you give us a summary on what that whole project was and turned out to be?
I'm really sorry for long answers, but this question is going to require a little bit of explanation. And I think that was one of the problems that Biosphere 2, which to our great surprise, captured the world's imagination. I don't know the, you know, the chronological age of you guys, but in the late 80s and early 90s, Biosphere 2 was like, you know, mainstream network news headlines and,
right,
you know, magazines and newspapers around the world, because it was so audacious. It was really daring. So Biosphere 2 was inspired by two things. One is, and why did we call it Biosphere 2? It was a project to make a mini biosphere, a mini biospheric system, because most people who live on Earth don't know that their life support system is not, you know, by way of some corporate logo, you know, company. Their life support literally is the global biosphere, the sphere of life that encompasses and has transformed the Earth. So we called it Biosphere 2, one, to bring attention to people that we are putting to a stress test the only biosphere known in the cosmos. And once one which, if it is destroyed and fails to function, will mean the death of ourselves first, and possibly most of the life on planet Earth. So the goal was to make a laboratory by making a mini. So when I say a mini biosphere, you know, you guys and your listeners need to just think about how huge planet Earth is. 25,000 miles in circumference, with, you know, depending on how you count them, 30 or 50 different biomes, deep ecology, oceans that we barely have looked at the bottom thereof, a stratosphere and ozone layer that protects all life on Earth from deadly radiation. Yeah, we're not going to make a model of planet Earth. <You can't. laughs> But our thought was, let's make a miniature biospheric system. So on a little over 3 acres of southern Arizona desert land, we built a facility that was virtually airtight, because otherwise it's not going to be a separate system. And we put in a number of, and I know a lot of my ecologist friends, biome, by the way, we all know what a biome is, even if you don't know the word, a rainforest, yeah, a grassland, mm-hmm, a coral reef. These are, you know, major connections. Anyway, we decided to make a mini biosphere that contained 5 analog wilderness biomes, from rainforest to fog desert, from Everglades wetland to a living coral reef ocean, put 8 people in there and have an agriculture that was so clean that it wouldn't pollute this little mini world. And this was Biosphere 2. It's pretty astonishing. And I encourage anyone who doesn't, you know, who's not familiar with it, you know, Google it and look at the photographs, you know, because it's kind of mind-boggling. As a human scale project, it's massive. That's why it took us 7 years to design and build this thing. It's huge. And to make it airtight was an engineering challenge that nobody in the world could accomplish.
That's crazy.
It's awesome.
When you're going through this like challenge of making this, and kind of how did you decide on the people who were going to go in there for the experiment, and what made you choose around 2 years to stay in there for?
Well, you know, I left out because that answer was getting tedious enough.
No.
Because the other major goal of Biosphere 2 is not only a new kind of Earth laboratory where we could really study how biomes interact with each other, how technology has to be redesigned so it doesn't kill the system. You know, clearly, if we went, you know, down to Home Depot or your local engineering shop and just brought technology in, the materials would pollute the system, all the machines and gadgets would further cause problems. But Biosphere 2 is also designed with space in mind. And it's not short-term space. We're not, you know, we're not crazy. We may be lunatics, I'll go with that, but we're not totally crazy. But, you know, but the idea of Biosphere 2 is, if humanity is ever to spread in space on a long-term basis, not on a short-term, you know, picnic lunch in a space station or et cetera, or a temporary lunar base. We're going to need to build, you know, systems that are ecologically resilient so that people don't go crazy. Can you imagine living your life in what NASA, the Chinese, the Europeans, who are looking at short-term life support, have designed for you? Hydroponic lettuce and potatoes and wheat and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the Chinese will have you eat insects, which is not a bad idea. But, you know, Biosphere 2 was, if we're going to actually expand in space, we're going to need to take a biosphere with us and learn how to make it out of space materials. So that's another pretty visionary thing.
Wow.
So the two, you know, back to your question, I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
No.
Oh,
well, yeah, I actually remembered. The 2 years was actually inspired by, at the time of the late 80s, that was kind of what most people thought it would take to send a human crew to Mars, maybe spend 4 or 6 months exploring, doing research on its surface, and come back. So that was the original idea. But, you know, to ecologists and to myself as a participant, it was so beautiful that we had, you know, 2 full years in there. And we can talk about Biosphere 2 was in a, you know, a southern Arizona desert, you know, kind of in the foothills of mountains. But inside, it was basically a tropical world. So we had seasons. And it was, you know, quite beautiful to go through the first year. We were learning how to be the crew of Biosphere 2. There was no manual on how do you become a biospherian. And it was especially beautiful to then spend the second year going through the same seasonal changes and, you know, what was happening in our biomes, what crops we were planting in the agriculture. Really, and why 8 people? Well, the American Army has decided that 8 is a good number for a platoon.
All right.
Wow.
It's awesome. Wow.
That's the, I believe, I'm not an Army kind of guy. but you know, picture, and one of our consultants put it really well, when you build a new world, you have all the problems in the world to solve. So we needed to have people who knew marine biology because we had an ocean and an Everglades system. We needed, you know, have people who knew crop systems. We had, you know, fortunately, a doctor from UCLA Medical School who was so inspired that he got licensed as a general practitioner in Arizona so he could be our resident doc. And we needed people who could take care of all of the technologies and management of the system and do research on top of it. So, and we also didn't expect, which actually happened, we had shared all of our infectious diseases training as a crew before we went in for the 2 years. So there was virtually no illness inside, but we had to plan for, well, if somebody who only, you know, if somebody who is the only person who knows how to do X and Y gets sick, we're screwed, right? So we trained people, you know, to be redundant, to be backup. And that's always very useful anyway, because we did all kinds of things to keep Biosphere 2 functioning.
That's so neat. So after all this is like said and done and the 2 years go by, do you guys come out of this with a feeling of accomplishing what you wanted to accomplish? Or was it kind of left, you know, was there a lot more work to be done in your minds, or was this a complete project and exactly how you guys wanted it to end?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of people, and especially if they just read superficial media about the project, really misunderstand it. Biosphere 2 was a huge investment. I mean, we're talking $1,990. $150 to $200 million.
Wow.
To do all the research, build prototypes, you know, we built a test module, etc. And it would have been nuts, absolutely crazy, if this was only designed to do a 2 year stunt. So Biosphere 2 is actually designed to be a 100 year experiment.
Wow.
Because and we called the first 2 years, I mean, it's amazing with an injection of oxygen. That's another interesting question, which people who know about the project might know from news stories. Almost nobody on the outside in our mission control nor the crew actually thought there was a high probability that we could stay in there for 2 years. We did. And then after that, there was 7 months of transition. We called it the transition, where detailed, you know, ecologists and technologists came in, one, to improve systems, because like any newly launched ship, and it was a complex ship, you know, there were a lot of systems that sucked. They took too much time. They were unreliable. They got improved. We'd learn enough farming in the system, and we're trying to, you know, support 8 people on a diet that includes meat, milk, and eggs. You know, we didn't want to disrupt a normal U.S. European diet on half an acre. So we also did crop improvements, better selection of crops. So the first crew, we only grew a little over 80% of our food, which is remarkable on half an acre,
right,
with light because of the, you know, the amount of sunlight. So the second crew achieved that. And then there was a second closure, which I have to say, those poor people in the second closure, mostly history has forgotten them. And the beautiful thing about that is they produced all of their food, and there was no problem of a decline in atmospheric oxygen. They didn't have to, you know, so we learned enormous, enormous amounts from Biosphere 2. But, you know, what I really hope we get, have time to get, if Biosphere 2 was only a historical footnote, you know, put it on the History Channel and hope that they do a decent job. But my contention is, and what we felt, what motivated us to do Biosphere 2, relevant as we continue to be trashing, careless, and negligent about our global biosphere. The number one thing we thought would end that mission, the first 2 year closure experiment, was that CO2 would rise in an uncontrolled way. So we had to become atmospheric managers to try to manage our CO2. Does this seem a little bit ahead of the curve?
Yeah, right.
We had to redesign, you know, so the real pioneers in biospherics and closed systems were the Russians, then the Soviets. You know, Vernadsky, one of their visionary guys, had laid out the basis of how does the biosphere operate and how has it transformed Earth. And the Russians, you know, who were out there competing with NASA, you know, for the moon, they were pioneers in space, but they recognized much more than NASA did that to actually live in space, we would have to have systems that regenerate with natural ecological means, air, water, and food. So they did pioneering work that's still ahead of what NASA's done. The Chinese have caught up to it quite a bit. So the legacy of Biosphere 2 is, you know, its relevance. How do people live in a mini biosphere has so much to teach us about how we live with Earth's biosphere.
It's amazing.
I mean, with everything that happened, all the hard work just to gather all this information and whatever, how's the feeling when, like, the second crew, for what I understand, like, the experiment got cut short because of funding and all? Is it something where you sit back and wish, like, we'd get more, like, government funding or have more, for lack of a better term, nowadays we have GoFundMes and stuff like that? Do you feel that we're not getting the backing that we need to look at some of this stuff right now?
Oh, I mean, totally. And you know, there was a takeover of Biosphere 2. I don't know whether you guys or your listeners, but they should watch Spaceship Earth. And we didn't make the film, but we did turn over a lot of archival material, because it does outline, you know, there was a power struggle. You know, we had created something that was impossible to create, and it became very valuable. So then there was a power struggle on how should Biosphere 2 be best utilized. And when the principal funder of Biosphere 2 kind of wrested control from my group, who were co-owners and managers, they didn't care about closed systems. They didn't want to have people in there. They want to have agriculture in there. They wanted to make it a more conventional science project, i.e. the biome should have separation so the rainforest could be studied separate from an ocean and the savanna from a desert. You know, we went back into, and I think this is one of the problems where science is not really serving us well. It is so compartmentalized. And there are even scientists that tell me that because we had 8 people in there who knew that their well-being and their life depended on that biosphere being healthy, that we were not objective. So they turned it into a model where scientists, you know, kind of literally or metaphorically in their white coats with their little clipboards, come in and study the biosphere. They study the rainforest. They study the savanna. And if we had done Biosphere 2 now and said it's essentially an experiment about trying to figure out how humans, technology, agriculture can coexist in a really harmonious way with the natural world, everyone would get it, right?
Right.
But that's still outside the bounds of reductionist, compartmentalized Western science. Astonishing.
It really is.
Depressing.
I'm curious. About a year ago, we had Mike Reynolds on, who is Earthships, and you know, you said New Mexico, and I was like, the way you're talking, I'm like, these guys had to have, like, I don't know, at least run into each other ideal wise and whatnot.
Oh, absolutely. I had the pleasure of going up and with a couple of other, the core team of Biosphere 2, Mike showed us the Earthships, and we share an interest because one part of the Earthships, I was the sewage manager of Biosphere 2. And, you know, once you make a completely sealed system, you were asking about recycling, then you have to figure out how do you regenerate air, water, how do you clean up sewage and put all the nutrients back to productive use. And so I fell in love with the system. It was a beautiful little constructed wetland. This is where we actually worked closely with a NASA researcher, Billy Wolverton, who you should get on your show because he's also the pioneer of indoor air quality as well as a pioneer in constructed wetlands. And after Biosphere 2, you know, one of the things that makes sense, and there's no way, you can't throw things away, you can't pollute, and you have to recycle everything. So I started a business international, and we made term. We said, you know, let's take sewage and turn it into beautiful spaces outside people's houses, hotels, businesses, small communities, and get them connected to what?
Oh, I don't know. We may have lost Mark on his connection.
Liquid. And all of our shower water and laundry water. And let's make beautiful gardens with it. And also preventing that water, you know, the marine environment, etc. You know, I love that the Earthships do a pretty total recycling of their wastewater.
Yeah, he was a great guest. He was a really, really interesting guy. It's really cool to hear people like yourself and him who've committed to, you know, a philosophy and also one kind of message throughout their whole living. It's really cool to talk to people like you guys.
You know, by the way, because you're making it sound like I've sacrificed something, what I love to say to people is that becoming ecological, first off, it gets you out of the fantasy. And when I give talks, you know, I really like to talk about the human experience of being in a closed system like that, being in a mini biosphere where it's not just your little brain and your little concepts and, you know, thought forms and science. You know, your body understands, oh, I am connected to this. You know, without this living system, my air is not going to be good. I would suffocate. I wouldn't have air to breathe. Without the system, you know, the water would be terrible. Without the system, I wouldn't have fresh food. So, you know, most modern people, and it's a real, you know, change from how humans mostly lived, we are in this fantasy that because we live in an urban environment, that we're not part and parcel of the biosphere. And I think that there's a great hole in, and I speak for myself, you know, for all the work I had done, you know, 20 years of work with the Institute of Ecotechnics in New Mexico, in Puerto Rico, in our project in the outback of Australia, I never got it the way I got it in Biosphere 2, because there's something about being in a confined, limited space that your body has to grok that. And, you know, for all of the eight of us and the second crew and people who spend time in there, that reality is so important. And I think it's the starting point for, one, losing a fantasy. And actually, if you appreciate how vital the biosphere is to you, whether you're in a rural or urban or wherever the hell you are, this is the reality. This is the beginning of, like, awakening. And I think we have to awake to the fact that we're part of the biosphere. That's why we came up with that kind of clunky term, biospherian, because we really wanted people who came to Biosphere 2 hear about it. You know, everyone, we are all biospherians, but we don't have an operating manual like Bucky Fuller, one of our heroes, pointed out. We're on this beautiful spaceship Earth that has this amazing biosphere. But no one gave us an operating manual. That's right. Kind of the human challenge. And because humans are so ingenious, and I am not a Rousseauian, I don't think we should throw out technology. We just have to reinvent it and rethink it to be, you know, a suitable partner to our global biosphere.
That's awesome.
Fun. Challenge.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. Mark, we could pick your brain for hours and on. We would love sometime down the road to bring you back on the show. If people want to learn about the Institute of Ecotechnics or what you're up to, where are the best places they can go?
Well, should I give you a couple of websites?
Yeah, throw them out there.
Okay, you know, I don't think we need the www. I hope everyone has realized that's just a waste of your typing skill. ecotechnics.edu We'll get you to the Institute of Ecotechnics with links to our current projects, which includes an ocean-going sailing ship that's being rebuilt in Catalonia, the Puerto Rico project. We're also modern ecologists. So, you know, the World City is one of the most dynamic biomes of the planet. So we have and, you know, we're also, you know, why should art and science be divorced? So our World City project is in London, and it's an art gallery featuring artists from around the world. Anyway, so all of that stuff is there. And if I could do a shameless plug, there's three books I want to mention. First one, if you're intrigued with shit, can we say this on your podcast?
Yeah,
you can. Fine.
Right. And we're talking not, you know, this is not a curse word. It's a technical term. If you're interested in shit, and how it should be recycled and reused, I wrote a book based on all the international work I did called The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time. Is that a killer title?
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
And it's probably the funniest book you'll ever read about shit. And then two books about Biosphere 2. I published a book called Pushing Our Limits, Insights from Biosphere 2 with the University of Arizona Press, which is kind of nice because the University of Arizona now manages the facility. And even though it summarizes a lot of what we tried to do, the results, it's very readable. And we just reissued a new second edition of Life Under Glass, which I wrote with two of the other biospherians. And the subtitle of that one is called crucial lessons in planetary stewardship. So
it's awesome.
And really, you know, spend $2 or $3 and stream Spaceship Earth as a good introduction to the topic. On YouTube, there's a Ecotechnics channel, and there are a number of videos about Biosphere 2 talks and other of our projects there.
That's awesome. Mark, thank you so much for your time. Stay safe out there and keep doing amazing things. It was really fun to talk to you for a few minutes.
Same here. Same here.
Thank you.
I know. I was expecting more shenanigans, guys.
Well, I guess my final question would be, how historically accurate was Pauly Shore's Biodome movie, out of curiosity?
You know, I'd gone back to make my Jewish mother proud, and I was getting a PhD at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And not that I appreciate I had 15 seconds or minutes of fame. But, you know, I kind of went slightly disguised to look at that movie.
That's
and
awesome.
What can you say about Pauly Shore? But I did find it interesting. You know, we had 4 women and 4 guys in Biosphere 2. That's a whole other story. But, you know, I kind of like that they were Hollywood starlets, and that I think they discovered something, as I remember the movie, that saved the Earth.
Yeah.
So historically accurate, you know, one of my colleagues, the Dr. Roy Walford, was into bungee jumping. And I noticed in the credits that he was a consultant, because if you remember, they were bungee jumping off of the space frame.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
No, Spaceship Earth is a much better film. But to me, it's a great film. It's a really good, you know, portrayal. And also, you know, at this point, I don't really give a stuff. I don't give a fuck. So, yeah, I mean, we were not conventional academic scientists. Conventional academic scientists would never have put their ass on the line and done such a daring project.
All right, Mike, Dr. Mark Nelson, I'm a little upset you didn't ask him what his take on cheese sticks was.
Yeah, I was wondering if they could grow them in the biosphere. Now, that would have made, like, he was talking about the press about it. That would have made, like, history. If it's like, listen, if you close yourself in for 2 years and you do the right things with dirt, cheese sticks just grow out of the ground. I don't know what to tell you.
Man, a cheese stick plant, I'd be on board with that.
Oh, you would be. You'd have a green thumb, man. You'd be all over that. No, you'd have like a whole plantation of cheese stick trees or something.
Scott's cheese stick farm.
I just see you with an all white suit, just smiling, looking around at your cheese stick trees and all.
just taking in the smell as the wind blows the cheese side to side.
Honey, you want coffee? No, dear. I'm smelling cheese sticks in the air.
Just a tight camera shot of me putting my hands, like rubbing them through the cheese stick leaves, like, you know, just living off the land.
Like you go up to one and it's a little moldy and you're like yelling at one of your workers and all, hey, we don't take this here. Pluck it off now.
Oh, God, this show has reached It's such an interesting dynamic, because I just keep telling you, basically every week, I think the show has evolved from me telling you how stupid I'm becoming, and our conversations get dumber and dumber, and then we bring on these, like, super intelligent, like, people who have done things for the planet and saved people's lives and accomplished things, and we're just sitting here talking about cheese stick farms.
I mean, all we have to do is make it happen, and then they'll be like, that's the smart people. That's what's stopping us, Scott. We come up with these quote-unquote stupid ideas, but if we make it happen, we'd be really, really smart.
Anyway, great guest. Yeah. What do you got, Mike?
Well, if you recall, like last week, we kind of went through Mother's Day and everything. I wanted to ask you something. It kind of ruffled me a little bit, not like mad, but I was wondering your take on this.
Okay.
So
give it to me.
As you've probably seen before, I do a lot of like cooking and baking and stuff like that, and I really get to enjoy it. And it's been kind of my thing for a little while.
Yep.
So we the weekend of Mother's Day, we knew we were going to be in the area. We were doing a 5K. We were going to go over to the parents and all. So.
Now, you don't have any baking costumes, do you? You're not like dressing up like the chef from Ratatouille or anything like that while you cook?
I don't. Not that. Not the Swedish chef. Nothing like that. It's just me out there. Now, when I have to go on runs, that's when the wife's like, here you go. And I'm like, okay. And
okay, I'll be Han Solo today.
Yep. That was last weekend. Yeah.
All right, but, continue.
But as you know, like I said, I do a lot of baking. In fact, like when the whole pandemic was going, like the parents didn't want us anybody to come over with concerns going, like I went out of my way for my mom's birthday. I made her a homemade from scratch carrot cake and all. Nice. Like literally scraping carrots, cooking it down, making the frosting, dusting it with nuts, all that. Like it made a special trip, even though we went into it saying, okay, maybe it's just drop it off, hey, enjoy, and then take off. But it was a nice thing. We actually got to hang around with them. So Mother's Day's coming up. I know I got that option. I love doing that. I get a call 2 days before Mother's Day from my dad. And he tells me, I know you do the baking thing, but your sister... I'm sorry, a week before Mother's Day, he called and said, your sister has bought a cake that's getting shipped down here, and we don't want to have a bunch of cake around here, so, like, bring your mom a plant. So it's one of those, like, okay, like, I know my sister lives in New Jersey, can't just come on down and do whatever, but it's also kind of like you could have shipped her some flowers, like you've seen the Instagrams and Facebooks. I'm kind of the cake guy, and you shipped a cake, and now all of a sudden, now I'm in the weird spot of I'm not really a plant guy. I don't know what kind of plant to get my mom. So,
listen, I don't send you cards. You got to wait for that, but I give you a cake. See, I think you still bring the cake. I think I would have. Maybe go pick up a plant for, you know, a couple bucks and bring that. But I think I'd also still bring your homemade cake and have a cake off.
I mean, it's not really a cake off. If somebody buys it, it doesn't really do any good. Now, the topper of all that was after we went through, okay, I got her a couple of like a big tree size thing from Home Depot and a flower and a broad. Oh, you did so well. Oh, by the way, your sister messed up. She thought Mother's Day was the week before, so we got the cake a week early.
So
cake. Like, it not only took away from what I do and what I enjoy, it literally came too early, and I couldn't find out to still do it.
Now, were you going to go with the same carrot cake, or you had something completely different in mind?
I would probably do the same carrot cake. Now, me personally, I love trying new and different things, so if I was making a cake for me, I'd be like exploring what can I do, what can I make, blah blah blah. But kind of like my mother, kind of like my wife, they're one of those I like something, I want that kind of group,
right? Yeah, I think the move I would have done, because I get this, like in my family dynamic, I'm always like the gift guy. Like I pride myself on giving good gifts and.
Gift man.
Yeah. Another terrible superhero.
Stop it, Joker, or you won't get this wonderful present.
Yeah, like if Father's Day is coming up, Dad's birthday, I'm the first to like reach out to the brother and sister. Hey, any ideas? Because generally, if you can go in on something, you can get a better gift. You know, like, you know, if you split it, I'm always the one to come up. For instance, my dad just turned 70 last week, and I was so excited about this gift for weeks, months leading up to it. So my father and I, on vacation, we like to windsurf. He has an old windsurfer that we use. And for in the last couple of weeks, months really, I've been showing him this. It's kind of a new sport. It's called wing surfing. Now, it's not the one you might have seen where people are on the surfboard and there's like they're tethered to a kite. This is actually where the sail has no mast and you hold the wing. It's actually inflatable, and these guys are whipping around on it. And part of the thing with the windsurfing, we have a very old board and it's very heavy, so it's a lot of like torque on my dad's back, and he's getting older. And in my head, I'm like, this looks like, I mean, we're watching videos on YouTube. There's a 12-year-old girl doing it. There's an older guy. Like, it looks like it's going to take a lot of the stress off of that. I'm like, you know what? This is a perfect present. Like, let's get him the wing. Because you can, and I go and I do research, and I'm talking to a guy at, like, the surf place. They were fantastic. And we're going back and forth. And I'm like, look, we can't afford a whole new board and all this stuff, but we would like to buy the wing. And he said that's actually the best way to learn on an older board. So long story short, I don't want to bore everybody, but so I'm excited for this present in weeks. And it's just like my brother is like, my sister's like the sure. She'll say sure to the idea. Never comes up with an idea. She's always like sure, which is great, you know? Because if I'm going to be the idea guy, the best thing I need from you, Mike, is just go, okay, I'm in. You know, that's the best. My brother, on the other hand, is the, I don't know, maybe in the weeks go by, let me check with my wife, blah, 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 blah. And it's just kind of like, oh, my God. And then my mother, she was like, yeah, I'm in. And then weeks later, she's like, I don't know, dad's getting older. And in my head, I'm like, I don't know how many more years I'm going to have my father. I'm going to get him this thing. I told them all. I said, I'm going to get it regardless. If you're in or out, I'm buying it. You know, and I'll put it on the credit card and pay it off. And then eventually they did go in, and as I predicted, blown away by the gift, like just so excited, like takes it out and is like researching it and can't wait to use it. So yeah, I understand it, that dynamic. It sucks when there's like my brother will be the same way with like, I'm always like, let's plan a vacation together. The years are going by. Yeah. We have our one family vacation. That's with like all our extended family. We haven't gone away with just our family in forever. And I'm like, the years are going by. Let's go somewhere. Let's all go to an all-inclusive. Let's go somewhere. And so it's like, I don't know. Why don't we go out to hibachi dinner? I'm like, hibachi dinner? Like, that's, you know.
I just see you, like, walking in with your suitcase. And I'm ready for a big family vacation here. We're going to see onion volcanoes and see shrimp fly through the air. Yeah. Man, I booked 2 weeks for this. I can't wait.
Yeah. So I guess in my family dynamic, I'm more of like the dreamer, like the let's do it. Let's just go bold. And my brother's like this, like it gets so frustrating to a point. I love him and all, but it's just like this prodding, long, drawn out process to get an answer for anything. I could be like, hey, Mike, you want to grill some burgers tonight? My brother now lives 3 miles down the road,
mm-hmm.
3 miles. And it's like, I don't know. Whereas I'm like, someone could text me right now, hey, you want to have a barbecue? I'm like, hell yeah, open door pop, yeah. Whatever. Let's just do it. Like, so, yeah, I do get that frustration in, like, a family dynamic where it's like, and this is what I do. You know, this is what – I wanted to do something nice, and it's kind of like stepping on my toes.
I just wish, like, one of your family members weren't paying attention where you're like, you were going to buy him a wing.
Yeah.
And then, like, they show up and they bring, like, ranch dressing thinking you bought them, like, buffalo wings or something like that.
Yeah.
But, here you go, Dad. I got the good stuff. It's from Caesars.
But I pride myself, like, I give my wife, I try to give really thoughtful gifts, like, things that are, like, outside of the box. And some people, I guess, just don't have the same, I don't know, passion for, but I'd rather get somebody something nice and chip it, like, than just like BS ticky-tack things that are going to be like gone or not really used. So, but I get where you're coming from. I think the play, I would have still made the cake, and you could have been like, isn't this cake so much better than this crappy store-bought cake?
I should have done a power play, though. Like, I show up for my parents, and I'm like, oh, look at that cake. Whoops! What are we going to do now?
Do you remember when Opie from Opie and Anthony stomped on that homeless man's cake? You should have done that to the cake. Just kicked it and like, get out of here. Like, just totally insulted. She's not even here. She's not even here. This is the cake we're eating.
No, I would have FaceTimed her. You know, I just like, hey, sis, how's it going? Just saw the cake and watch it fly.
You know what you should have done? You should have put your cake on a nice, like, heavy tray and put her cake out and then set your cake on top of her cake. So it would just squat. Yeah. So it's like a plate.
Yeah. And then, like, as I'm like, ooh, this is delicious. I mean, not the bottom layer. That's terrible. This tastes like week old cake there, Donnie. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think next year you reload and you come guns blazing, maybe with two cakes, two types of desserts. And you go, you know what? I'm bringing it regardless because people will appreciate that. They will be like, oh. And then if they don't want the cake, you take the rest home and you have cake for yourself.
I might just go screw it and all and just beat her to the punch and like bring a cake 3 weeks later and say, surprise, happy Mother's Day.
You should send it early with all the Mother's Day cards you never sent your mom. So it's like,
I got her. She got it on time this year.
All right, Berlo, you're turning over a new leaf.
Yeah. Not only did I give my mother, since I wasn't around for my dad's birthday, I handed off his birthday card too and all. It made him tear up a little bit.
It's great to see you changing, Mike. When a man's changing his ways.
I'll just quickly say, since we're on a new podcast network, for any new listeners, I have a history of buying my Mother's Day, Father's Day, birthday cards, all that. I have a history of buying them on time, but they magically never get shipped out, and I forget about them, so I've already had a situation when I moved from Jersey to Georgia to find 20 different birthday and Christmas and holiday cards. By the way, don't know where they're at again, so I still have to go out and buy them.
See, this goes back to how we opened the podcast. We're getting stupider. We're losing things. We're devolving week to week. But
Maybe it would be nice, like, if I pass away before my parents, they go in my attic and all, oh, he really did love us. Look at all these. Oh, my God. Thank God and all. I mean, I didn't go to his funeral or nothing, but this makes me wish I did.
Depends if they were written out. If they're not written out, I would be like, he hates us. If they were written and never sent, I'd be like, oh, he was just dumb.
It just has like very old messages. I love you. Hope you, the Y2K bug doesn't show up on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't believe the Bills lost four in a row, but happy Father's Day. It's time to roll, Mike. Anything to promote before we get on out of here?
I will promote. Went to a new brewery. I think I'm on 37 now in Georgia. It's called Bold Monk Brewing Company. It's in the heart of Atlanta. Absolutely amazing restaurant, brewery, beer garden. They have a beautiful outside area. They have an upstairs library where you can read some books while you're enjoying a nice meal and all. Their wings were absolutely amazing. They fried them with duck confit and cayenne and chili honey and all. I crave them right now. Amazing brews also. Check them out. If you're in Atlanta, they are called Bold Monk Brewing Company.
All right. And I will promote. I have another outdoor lake show coming up on July 9th. It is at Rock Ridge Community Club. It is open to non-members, whereas like some of these shows, these outdoor shows are, you know, kind of limited to the people who live there. This one is open to the public. It's $25. And you will see Mike Burton, Matt Jenkins, Jackie Byrne, and myself. So it is a cool hang. It's outside right on the lake. So for more information, go to Rock Ridge Lake, New Jersey, and check out and get some tickets.
I got to be honest. Like, as you said, Mike Burr, I kind of chimed up like, what?
Oh, that would be great.
I'm back? What?
That would be great. when you visit Jersey, I'm definitely doing that too. I'm definitely putting you on Tap House for like 10 minutes, just throwing you in there. But yeah, guys, that's it. Check us out on all different various podcast platforms. Recently, we joined Podcast City Network, as Mike said. We're also on the BS Podcast Network, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, you name it, Google Play, iHeartRadio, all that stuff. So leave us a review. That helps us out, and we like to see it. We like to know that you love us. Other than that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it, and keep the wind at your back.
I'm going upstairs to make my Father's Day cake. I'm getting it 2 months in advance.